Check, check. Thank you to everyone for the support for the first episode. Thank you to Awareness for the music. I recently spoke to the legendary historian Gerald Horn. He has over 30 books out on Paul Robeson, Shirley Graham Du Bois, W.E.B. Du Bois, William Patterson, and covers topics from the present to deep in the past, interrogating the roots of resistance, white supremacy, slavery, and colonialism. From the book Fire This Time about the Watts Uprising in the 60s, to Facing the Rising Sun about Afro-Asian solidarity, to Fighting in Paradise that spoke about the Confederacy and white supremacy in the South Pacific, with blackbirding and ongoing slavery after the Civil War, which was also in his book The White Pacific, to the Counter-Revolution in 1776 that displayed the Revolutionary War was less about the Stamp Act and more about upholding slavery as well as colonizing west of the Appalachian Mountains. To his book Confronting Black Jacobins about the Haitian Revolution, Horn's work and perspective is broad. Gerald Horn is a revolutionary scholar and in-depth researcher. He holds a Morris Professorship of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. I had interviewed him previously for an article titled Decolonizing the Classroom, Embracing Radical Internationalism, that is up on Truthout and also in the journal Radical Teacher. Today I spoke to him about his new book, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century America and the Caribbean. We dug into topics ranging from his teaching philosophy, Enlightenment philosophers and the extension of white supremacy, Nathaniel Bacon, the Glorious Revolution, ongoing examples of colonialism such as families being separated at the border, and current anti-fascist movements.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay. Cool. And, well, I just want to say that as a teacher, I'm grateful for the scholarship you do, the research you do. When I get these state history textbooks, I always work in your work, and it supplements so well. And when I teach at Regis University, I use your like the Counter-Revolution of 1776.
Oh, good. Good, good. Well, if you're in Colorado, I mean, you obviously need an alternative explanation for how the Native Americans lost all their land out there.
Yes.
You need an alternative explanation.
Yeah, because it always starts with the gold rush or something like this, you know. It's not history at all. It's a form of propaganda, so.
Oh, yeah, I know. It's ridiculous.
Well, my first question is, when I spoke to you last time, we talked about representations of resistance in the classroom with not having students see the first image of a person of color as someone enslaved, but learning about ancient Kemet or Ashanti first. Can you speak about your teaching philosophy and how this relates to the work you do?
Well, I accept wholly and fully the predicate of your question. I think that particularly with regard to students of African descent, but not exclusively students of African descent, it's very important for them not to see black people only in the role of slaves, for example. And even if dealing with the ineffable, unavoidable history of enslavement in North America, which, by the way, also ensnared millions of indigenous people as well, it's important to portray them as actors, that is to say, as seeking to collaborate with the enemies of their enslavers, for example. Of that, there is abundant evidence in one of the many scandals of historiography in the United States is not dealing with that history, which I think leads to a misimpression that the slave population was inert, or as the designer slash rapper Kanye West said, that 400 years of slavery is a choice, basically. I mean, that kind of opinion comes clearly from this idea of presenting enslaved people as passive. Mm-hmm. Now, with regard to teaching, particularly the history of North America, I think, number one, students need an explanation of why we're speaking English in the first instance, particularly given that, as I say in my book, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, that in the early 1600s, England was fundamentally a minor power in Europe. And students need to understand how this minor power in the early 1600s became a major power by the late 1600s. And of course, the answer in brief is slavery. I think that it's important in talking about settler colonialism and European settler colonialism in North America to also deal with the conflicts and contradictions in Europe, not least the Ottoman Empire, that is to say, Turkey, and not least the religious conflict between Muslims and Christians and Jewish people, and between Protestants and Catholics, and between Catholics and Jewish people, and how somehow all of those conflicts in the 17th century get resolved on the basis of the common altar of race. That is to say, it reminds me of the Michael Jackson video, Beat It. Have you seen, remember that video?
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, there, you know, the two gangs, and then Michael Jackson comes between them and sort of reconciles them. Well, this is what happens between the Protestants and the Catholics. They say, you know, why are we fighting? We should unite under this common banner of whiteness, and we can loot everybody. Basically, that's what happened. So, let the transcript show the speaker is now chuckling. And so in any event, that's part of what I try to impart to my students.
Yeah, and you spoke about when all of the Dutch, French, Spanish came over, then they all kind of homogenized into this structure of whiteness, as you're mentioning.
Oh, yeah. It's you have this transition from religion as the axis of society to race. And what's interesting is that you have many bourgeois analysts and scholars. They laud the United States because they say that if you look at the First Amendment, the United States moved away from religious conflict of Europe and guaranteed freedom of religion, which is true, but they don't go make the next statement, which is that there was basically a shift from religion to race.
So these scholars and analysts, they glorify the First Amendment because it guarantees freedom of religion. But what they don't mention is that this was a maneuver by the settlers to gain more numbers by downplaying religious conflict and helping to attract more settlers by guaranteeing that they would not be bedeviled by religious conflict. And that the flip side of that, of course, is that they could then benefit from seizing the land of Native Americans and enslaving Africans. And so you have a shift from religion to race as the axis of society in North America. And what's striking is that you have scholars today talk about what they call the Enlightenment. And you would think that the Enlightenment, that is to say this move away from religion and towards what might be called a rational or materialist approach, came solely and exclusively from the heads and the brains of geniuses, as opposed to being an adaptation to facts on the ground in North America in particular, and in colonial settings, whereby you needed to broaden the base for settler colonialism by extending and expanding it beyond religion, and then drawing upon a population pool that stretches from the Atlantic to the Ural Mountains in Russia, that is to say, a population that could be defined as white, and even dipping down into the Arab world to define them as white too. Danny Thomas, a popular comedian of the 1950s, was of Syrian origin. Ralph Nader, the consumer advocate, is of Lebanese origin. Even dipping into Persia, the head of Uber is of Iranian origin. he's considered to be white. There's a new book from Stanford Press called The Limits of Whiteness that deals with Iranians being defined as white in North America. But, of course, what happens is that instead of being seen as sort of an adaptation of settler colonialism to generate enough numbers to overawe and overmatch indigenous populations and Africans, this is seen as some sort of stroke of genius, liberalized, so to speak. And what's even more ironic is that the so-called Enlightenment scholars and devotees of the Enlightenment, they talk about a rational approach to phenomena, but when it comes to responding to what I just articulated, they're all thumbs. As I said, they don't talk about how this move away from religion was a creative adaptation to the perils of colonialism generally, and settler colonialism in particular. And of course, it wasn't until the Haitian Revolution, 1791 to 1804, that you got tremendous pushback against this construction of race and slavery, and then complemented in the 20th century by the rise of socialism, Bolshevik Revolution, etc. And this is where we are today.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was actually going to be one of my next questions. You've said that the $64,000 question is elusive of the origins of global white supremacy, and you and Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz have suggested it lay in the Crusades.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of your footnotes, you say a scholar dates the word race back to 1508. Do you find its origins with Christendom, colonialism, capitalism, or a combination of all three?
Yeah, I would say a combination of all three. You know, it's interesting. I mean, I'm working on a book now on the 1500s.
Is that the dawning of the apocalypse?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you begin to see, like, if you look at the Crusades, which you can plot from the late 11th century, these are pan-European projects from the inception. They're taking Christians from all over Western Europe to march to what might be called the Holy Land and to oust the Muslims. And you could easily see how this concept, and then of course we all know that slavery is a phenomenon in any case during that period, not only enslaving of Africans, but of course enslaving of other Europeans. Galley slaves, for example. We need more research on galley slaves, that is to say the people who were propelling vehicles on the seas were enslaved. We all know about the roots of slave in general, in terms of how people in Slavic world were heavily subjected to enslavement. So I would say that the Crusades would be one root of not only slavery, but pan-Europeanism, which then bleeds into whiteness. I would also suggest that looking at the Iberian Peninsula and the fact that Muslims were ruling in Spain from about 711 in the so-called Christian era, A.D., up until they were formally ousted, circa 1492, and then expelled altogether in 1609. And this conflict in Spain between Muslims and Christians is, it seems to me, a predicate for the construction of whiteness, not to mention the expansion of Spain across the Atlantic. And indeed, what befalls the Muslim population on the Iberian Peninsula in the 1500s is strikingly similar to what befalls the indigenous population of the Americas and Africans as well in the 1500s, that is to say, falling victim to enslavement. And then, of course, whiteness being sort of the vehicle that propels that. Another aspect that I think we're going to have to deal with is what's happening in the 1300s with the African leader Mansa Musa. The story is well known about how he's a Muslim, and then, of course, in terms of dealing with the rise of enslavement of Africans and the rise of whiteness, you have to contemplate that some of the earlier areas subjected to enslavement in so-called sub-Saharan Africa were heavily Muslim-dominated, as they are today. What is now present-day Senegal, what is now present-day Guinea. Guinea, of course, used to be sort of a synonym for all black people. What is now present-day Mali, for example. And Mansa Musa, as is well known, he was a Muslim ruler, and his trans-Saharan voyage, if you like, across Africa on his Hajj was a major event of the 1300s. And this idea of African wealth that he exhibited attracted the dedicated attention of many potential colonizers, which actually, when I think about Mansa Musa, I also think about the movie Black Panther. Have you seen that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where you have this African kingdom and they're trying to keep their wealth shrouded, so mm-hmm. to speak. And I think that Mansa Musa might have been better off if he had not made such an exhibition of the vast wealth that he was controlling, because it tended to attract the ravenous attention of outsiders to the detriment of his people. But in any case, I think that in terms of explaining and shedding light on the dawning of the apocalypse or the dawning of settler colonialism, it's important to understand the Crusades. It's important to understand what was going on in the Iberian Peninsula, particularly Spain. And it's also important to understand the phenomenon that was Mansa Musa.
This next question ties into the 1400s. And in your book, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, and I'm just going to read a part, it's so well written. What is euphemistically referred to as modernity is marked with the indelible strain of what be termed the three horsemen of the apocalypse, slavery, white supremacy, and capitalism, with the bloody process of human bondage being the driving and animating force of this abject horror. So I wanted to tie in Enrique Dussel, the philosopher. In his work, Invention of Americas, he says the birth date of modernity is 1492, and with it the myth of a special kind of sacrificial violence which eventually eclipsed whatever was non-European. Do you agree that this is when modernity began, in 1492?
Well, sure. I mean, that's as good a date as any. You could also say 1095 with the origins of the Crusades, but 1492 is as good a time as any, not only because it leads to Christopher Columbus, who, by the way, had significant experience in West Africa before he crossed the Atlantic. And if you look at his diaries and journals, he's repeatedly comparing the indigenous populations that he encounters with West Africans, to the detriment of both, I might add. So certainly that voyage, which leads to the enslavement of the indigenous populations and forcing them to work in mines and produce wealth, the defeat of the Aztecs and the Incas in Mexico and Peru, and then the gradual extension of enslavement to Africans, and then, by the way, the Spanish also, who in the 16th century were also involved in the Philippines, had begun a Filipino slave trade as well, bringing them to Mexico to work as bonded laborers as well, a fact that's oftentimes neglected, unmentioned. And then 1492 not only marks the origins of that horrific process, but it also marks an acceleration of the Inquisition and the expulsion of the Jewish population from Spain. Of course, I deal with that in the Apocalypse book. And, of course, the as I said before, the beginning of the final defeat of the Muslims and their final expulsion by about 1609. So, yes, I think that seeing 1492 as a turning point is quite appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to move up a little bit now to 1676 with Bacon's Rebellion, and you say this was a turning point, creating a cross-class collaboration between and among Europeans that has yet to disappear in North America, the headquarters of settler colonialism. And as you point out, some on the left or some historians are split on this, and they portray this, as you say, a revolt from below targeting an elite is ipso facto righteous. Can you speak on this misinterpretation of?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, let's look at the United States in 2018, when you have a vulgar, alleged billionaire as president, actually a con man, who obviously received significant support from the Euro-American working class and middle class, even though some of our friends on the left torture the numbers until you would think that the only people who voted for Donald Trump were Ivanka and Eric and Donald Jr., which is obviously false. He got 63 million votes. Won Wisconsin, Michigan, not to mention Dixie, where routinely the right wing wins 90% of the Euro-American vote, and an amazing cross-class coalition. And so what I'm suggesting is that obviously we need a new interpretation of the history of the United States and the history of its origin as a settler colony. And Bacon's Rebellion is something of an exemplar because it represents the kind of class forces that you see then materializing in 2016 November. That is to say, in Bacon's Rebellion, you see that those increasingly defined as white are rising up against London and the colonial structure because they don't think that the colonial structure is moving rapidly enough and aggressively enough to seize the land of the Native Americans. And, of course, that's an impetus also for 1776, a scant century later, when, per the Royal Proclamation of 1762-63, London expressed exasperation at continually moving west, expending blood and treasure, seizing the land of Native Americans so it could be turned over to real estate speculators like George Washington. Mm-hmm. Although, admittedly, there was a trickle-down to poor Europeans. I think it would be a mistake to act like there wasn't something called the, quote, American dream, unquote. That is to say, people starting off relatively poor and becoming wealthy. I mean, that did happen. But you, once again, like our discussion of the First Amendment, you have to turn that coin over and see how that comes at the expense of other people.
Mm-hmm.
It comes at the expense of seizing land of Native Americans, enslaving Africans, et cetera. And so London was faced with the real dilemma in 1676 because at the same time, the Caribbean, particularly Barbados and Jamaica, were quite typically on fire. The Native Americans in what is now New England were rebelling. And it was easier to try to accommodate the European settlers in Virginia, where Bacon's Rebellion takes place, as opposed to conciliating the Africans, whose unpaid labor you needed from a colonial point of view in the Caribbean, or the indigenous population in what is now New England, because their land was, quote, needed, unquote. So this leads, of course, to the accelerated move away from religion as an axis of society to race, whereby you could accommodate and conciliate poor Europeans, giving them a social promotion through the device of whiteness, and also try to seize more Native American land to accommodate them, and also move away from indentured labor, which was quite horrific in terms of its exploitation, and move more towards enslaved African labor, which all, you also see after 1676. So, as I say in the book, 1676 is a real turning point in the history of settler colonialism in North America.
Yeah, and this is also when a lot of that new legislation was introduced into Virginia as well, that really gave more of a foundation of what whiteness was to be.
Oh, sure. Sure. It's, you know, fortunately, we have a substantial literature on whiteness. It's been one of the major innovations, I would say, in scholarship in recent decades. And so you can trace this quite adequately through the existing literature.
Well, my next question, I think you already kind of answered, but what I was saying was, you mentioned that Nathaniel Bacon was from a wealthy family. He created this bridge to colonize indigenous land. I was going to say, do you see intersections with him and Donald J. Trump, his attack on the Latinx Chicano population, and his instant approving of the Keystone and Dakota Access Pipeline?
Well, clearly. I mean, obviously. And it's becoming more ominous by the day. What Donald J. Trump is doing, which sadly and unfortunately many of our progressive friends have not, is he's globalizing, he's internationalizing his movement. If you notice, as we speak, he's castigating Prime Minister Theresa May in London and touting as a potential successor Boris Johnson, her recently defrocked foreign secretary, who is to her right in Germany. He has been castigating the traditional conservative Chancellor Angela Merkel and his ambassador in Berlin, Richard Grenell, has gone on record as saying that he sees part of his job as boosting forces to the right of traditional conservatives, sort of the neo-fascists who now rule in both Rome and in Vienna. And what's remarkable is that despite this tremendous electoral victory in Mexico just days ago, I don't see a parallel movement of our progressive friends to try to send delegations immediately, if not sooner, to Mexico City to confer with our counterparts in the progressive movement in Mexico City in light of the tremendous victory of López Obrador, next president of Mexico. Of course, not only that individual, but then you have comrades around him who were actually to his left. So certainly there is a parallel between Nathaniel Bacon and Donald J. Trump. In fact, I'm awaiting one of our creative artists either do poems or paintings or plays drawing parallels between Nathaniel Bacon and Donald J. Trump.
That would be a great project, and very important as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the next question is 1688. So when I teach U.S. history to Reconstruction, to check the box on the Glorious Revolution, all the textbook says is William III and his wife Mary II became co-rulers in the, quote, relatively bloodless Glorious Revolution. So in your work, The Kind of Revolution of 1776, and your new work, Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, you talk of something much more sinister going on, the deregulation of the slave trade. Can you elaborate on this?
Well, what's basically happening, as I talk about in the Apocalypse book, is that you have the slow but steady rise in the 17th century of the merchant class. They have what might be called a premature victory with the rise of Oliver Cromwell in the 1640s and the beheading of a king. And, of course, one of the turning points comes in 1655 when under Oliver Cromwell, the English are able to oust the Spanish from Jamaica, which opens up more land for European settlement, opens up more avenues for enslavement of Africans, leads to the sugar boom, creating more wealth, pouring into the coffers of London, which allows London to build more ships to joust with the Dutch, who were a permanent power at that time, more ships to transport the sugar across the Atlantic to other ports, more ships to transport settlers into the Americas, more ships to transport enslaved Africans, leading to, of course, you have a working class building these ships, planting the seeds of capitalism in England. You have the rise of a banking industry because voyages of the slave ships and financing of all this industry has to be financed through banks. You have the rise of an insurance industry because there are shipboard insurrections, so you have to insure against the Africans taking over a ship and throwing the crew into the sea. So you have a circle devoid of virtue being created, generating tremendous wealth, which in some ways is at odds and in contradiction with the power of the monarch, who is seeking to keep the African slave trade in particular under the thumb of the monarch per the organization or the Royal African Company in 1672. But all along, you have merchants who are seeking to end that monopoly and clamoring for deregulation of the African slave trade. Free trade in Africans was their cry. And finally, in 1688, you see a triumph of the merchants. You see a clipping of the wings of the monarch, with the monarch on a glide path to where Queen Elizabeth is today. That is to say, quite wealthy and quite powerful, but certainly not as powerful as earlier monarchs, for example. And you have the rise, the acceleration, I should say, of the African slave trade with the deregulation of the African slave trade, with the monarchs descending upon Africa with the maniacal energy of crazed bees manacling and handcuffing every African in sight, dragging them across the Atlantic to produce even more wealth. And then, of course, you have the rise of parliamentary power as well, with merchants claiming a portion of political power to the detriment of the monarch through the rise of parliament. And that, in sum, is how I represent 1688.
Yeah, and it's when I had first read the Counter-Revolution of 1776, it really opened my eyes, and I started integrating that into the early U.S. North America history class. So thank you for that and your work. So this next question is in response to migrant families being separated. Director in Ojibwe, Jesse Wente, tweeted, "Colonial states separate children from parents because they know it works. It destroys and traumatizes for generations. It's an attack on the future as well as the present. It's not a partisan issue, it's a colonial one." Can you speak on this and this long legacy of colonialism and white supremacy? This timeline you've drawn out.
Sure. There is a young historian at Emory University in Atlanta by the name of Don Peterson who's just written a book on the inglorious history of Native American adoption into European settler colonial families. And you can draw a straight line from that dastardly history to recent scandals, for example, not only on the Texas-Mexico border, because what's going to happen now is that the alleged inability to find the parents of some of these youth who've been sequestered lead to their being doled out to U.S. families. But simultaneously, if you look at what's been going on in El Salvador for years now, you've had a kind of fraudulent adoption industry taking place where youth from El Salvador are being adopted by U.S. settler families, oftentimes by means that are hardly fair, mostly foul. And then it reminds me, actually, I think this is one of your fellow Coloradans, U.S. military officer in the 19th century, who most infamously said that nits make lice. And so therefore, you not only have to deal with Native American adults, you have to deal with Native American infants.
Was that Shivington?
To be adults. Yeah, I think that was Shivington.
Yeah, John Shivington, yeah.
Because they grew up to be adults. So given this history, and also given the history of U.S. foreign policy, for example, in the 1970s, U.S. imperialism supported the Argentine junta, which was quite notorious for seizing the children of leftists and dissidents, throwing the parents into the Atlantic Ocean, and then doling out the children to be adopted by military officers in the junta. In fact, that policy was so notorious, it led to a quite affecting film, which I recommend, called The Official Story. It's an Argentine film. So then, of course, we don't even have to talk about the African slave trade, which quite notoriously, the images are rampant of slave owners and slave traders ripping infants from the arms of weeping mothers and selling the mother down the river and selling the infant down another river. In fact, it's so notorious, it was a key and penultimate scene in the TV series Roots, which played on U.S. television. And, of course, there was a second version that came out a few decades later. So these are, shall we say, open secrets. They're not secrets at all, in fact. They're open scandals. I think that's the better phrase that can be used.
Yeah, and these things tie right back into the Carlisle School of separating Native Americans and trying to take away their culture as well. This cultural genocide that took place.
Oh, clearly. It's a clear case of appropriation. And, you know, it's interesting. Doing this research of the 1500s and dealing with the Muslim population in Spain, for example, after the Muslims are ousted after ruling for hundreds of years. And so the new Christian authorities, they ban certain dances that the Muslims engage in, certain food and recipes that the Muslims used to engage in. And it's a very curious form of not necessarily cultural appropriation, but cultural liquidation, which is also a phenomenon that we have witnessed under settler colonialism in North America.
And you also had European philosophers kind of aiding that, right? Like you spoke about Montague saying Islam was despotism.
Yes, yes. Right, right. Well, I mean, this whole conflict, see, circa 1512, it's fair to say that the Ottomans, the Ottoman Turks probably had the most powerful military. And in the Apocalypse book, I posit that the defeat of the Ottomans in 1683 at the gates of Vienna was a turning point in terms of the rise of Western Europe, settler colonialism, because actually up until the early 19th century, you still had cases of U.S. nationals, Euro-Americans, being kidnapped and enslaved off the coast of North Africa. Although it begins to decline after 1683, and once Western Europeans ran less risk of being enslaved themselves as they sailed southward into Africa, that is to say, being enslaved in Algeria or sold into the slave markets in Istanbul. With 1683, there's less of a chance for that, even though, as I said, it continues up until the 19th century. And so this whole question of Islam is a major factor that is not only rearing its head in the 21st century, but this conflict between Muslims and Christians has been a staple of European history, stretching back to the founding of Islam in what might be called the 7th century.
Well, this is my last question, and I think you've kind of already tapped into your famed crystal ball with where you went with your last response, but your underlying message I see in your work is internationalism. And you end your book stating, the impact of global currents on the nefarious domestic trends should remind today's strugglers that their interests would be better served by spending less time debating with the American Civil Liberties Union about the rights of fascists and more time conversing with potential and actual allies in Beijing, Moscow, Havana, Brussels, Pretoria, and elsewhere. Can you speak about how throughout U.S. history, such as Chile or Guatemala, the U.S. has supported fascism in its foreign policy, the roots of slaves, and the current attack on Antifa, such as anti-mask legislation in the U.S. and the current anti-fascist movement?
Well, I've been thinking about Chile a lot lately, because you know, I'm quite familiar with the overthrow of the socialist government on September 11, 1973, of Salvador Allende and the rise of Augusto Pinochet. And the reason, one of the reasons I've been thinking about it is because many progressive Chileans were just shocked by the rise of fascism. They thought that their democratic structures were less fragile and brittle than they actually were. And it reminds me of the United States, because people in the United States seem to be shocked by the rise of Donald Trump, these neo-fascist trends. They overestimated the strength of their, quote, democratic institution. Although I must say that people in the United States have less reason to be shocked than the people of Chile. Even though, of course, you had settler colonialism in Chile and you had a certain level of enslavement in Chile as well, but not to the dimensions you had in North America. And so it's shocking to me that in a country built upon genocide of Native Americans and enslavement of Africans to whom the Constitution and the Bill of Rights did not apply, that people could be shocked that that might serve as a precursor and a precondition for the rise of neo-fascism in 2018. I mean, obviously, there's been an overestimation, it seems to me, of democratic traditions in the United States, which, of course, brings us to Guatemala and the overthrow of the Arbenz government in 1954 and the subsequent studies that suggested that U.S. imperialism helped the Guatemalan military execute a kind of genocide against the indigenous population of Guatemala. My next book deals with Southern Africa and the neo-fascist trends that preceded 1994 and the election of Nelson Mandela, supported all along the line by U.S. imperialism. So, and then, of course, I've already spoken about how the Trump team is bolstering neo-fascists in Rome and Vienna and Berlin and elsewhere. So, obviously, you know, we have a lot of work to do. I mean, that's for sure. But I think our work could be facilitated if we had a clearer understanding of how we got to this point. And if we cast aside these fantasies and illusions that masquerade as U.S. history.
Yes. And you're calling for working with anti-fascists in other countries as well.
It's absolutely.
Internationalism that you
absolutely
always
espouse. Absolutely, absolutely. Reference what I just said about delegations to Mexico City to begin
with. Exactly. Well, thank you so much for speaking to me. As always, I'm so grateful to talk to you, and I always learn so much.
Anytime. Take care of yourself.
Thanks again to Awareness for the music. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please subscribe and rate the show, spread the word, and send me any questions or guest suggestions or anything else to my email, timewraps@riseup.net. Peace.